Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Religion, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Lindsay Jackson. Why are Americans, and American politicians more specifically, obsessed with sex? Why, in the words of Janet Jacobson, are gender and sexuality such riveting public policy concerns in the United States? In The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics, Jacobson answers this question by breaking apart the standard narrative that religion is primarily responsible for the moral regulation of sexuality. Instead, Jacobson proposes taking a kaleidoscopic approach to better understand the dynamics of sexual politics. Using this approach, Jacobson analyzes sex when it is the focus of the discussion and demonstrates how sex remains consequential even when it appears to be on the periphery. Jacobson's kaleidoscopic approach allows the reader to see the complex dynamics of sexual politics and challenges the assumption that religion is the basis for sexual values. Janet Jacobson is Claire Tau Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, Columbia University. Hi, Janet, and welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate this chance to talk with you.
It's absolutely my pleasure. So let's start by talking about the origins of this project. What made you want to write The Sex Obsession?
Yes, I often ask myself that question. The book has sort of two points of origin. One is a longer term genesis, which is about a series of collaborative projects that I've participated in ever since really I came to Barnard College and took up the directorship of the Barnard Center for Research on Women, which I did for 15 years. And those are collaborations across disciplines amongst scholars. For example, I'm currently involved in two transnational projects, one with my colleague Elizabeth Bernstein in sociology on gender justice and economic justice, and one with my colleague at Columbia, Laila Abulugod, on gender and the framing of violence in relation to discourse about religion. And also I co-write a lot because I believe in collaboration. And most importantly, especially for the origin of this book, with Anne Pellegrini on two projects, one called Love the Sin, Sexual Regulation and the Limits of Religious Tolerance, and the other called Secularisms, which is a global project about religion and secularism. And then finally, at the Barnard Center for Research on Women, there were a lot of collaborations between activists and academics that were about producing knowledge in the context of social movements. And those also were really formative to the book. And then I stepped down from BCRW in 2015, and I was interested in what was happening around me. And as you know, that was the start of the US election cycle. And literally, I stepped down on June 30th, and a few weeks before Donald Trump had announced his candidacy for the presidency of the United States, with that trip down the elevator and his denunciation in particular of immigrants around questions of sexual violence. And so I really wanted to respond to that and to the ways in which the idea that that type of appeal to, some sense of xenophobia and sexual violence could be the opening commitment by a candidate for the presidency of the United States is a very serious thing. And so I wanted to respond to that. And what I found was in doing research over the past 5 years is that the United States is sort of trapped in a political discourse that is divided between some idea that there are religious conservatives who embody that conservatism, most importantly through sexual conservatism, and secular liberals who are dedicated to including gender equality and sexual freedom. And that idea of a division between those two was everywhere. It was the common sense of American political discourse. You could find it in liberal publications. You know, I start out with a quote from The New Yorker in part because it's seen as one of the most, you know, sort of bastions of American liberalism in the popular press. And you could find it in conservative places too. And so I tried to understand this opposition. Why is it common sense when, for those of us who are trained in religious studies as I am, the presumption that there is any singular position in what's broadly called religion on gender and sexuality is simply not true. And yet, trying to say it's not true in political discourse, you just sort of disappear from the scene. So people who have various types of sexual commitments across religions or historical diversity across religion just are not available at all in public discourse. And I document some of that in the book. And what I found was that this opposition between religious conservatism and secular liberalism, which we in religious studies would not find to be accurate, nonetheless held political discourse in place. And it held it in place in an opposition that we were stuck in. There were two sides of an argument and only two, and each side was to be tolerated. You know, in Love the Sin, Anne and I talk a lot about the ways in which some idea of tolerance forms political discourse in the United States. So we contrast, for example, religious tolerance to a broader, more open sense of religious freedom. And what that produces is a stuckness. We go back and forth and back and forth between these two sides, and also a way in which we start to have to tolerate hate. That's what we say in A Love the Sin. And you can see it in the ways in which we have come in the United States to tolerate all kinds of, you know, very serious white supremacy and take it as simply the representation of one side of political argument. And, you know, this was, again, shown most clearly by our current presidents. You know, there are good people on both sides in relation to a white supremacist march in Charlottesville. But the overall sense of needing to be tolerant toward these two sides rather than any substantive engagement with them was part of what I was trying to get at and hopefully create some space where it might be easier to talk in ways that are not stuck in this opposition.
So I'm wondering if we could unpack this opposition that you're mm-hmm. pointing to a little bit. So religious conservatism versus secular liberalism. What is the root of this opposition and why do we tend to see these two as a binary?
Yeah, that's a really great and helpful question. So first of all, the way that the binary gets produced is by a series that repeatedly narrows political discourse. So, for example, when we talk about religion in public life, what is really meant, at least in the U.S., is not religion to core all the different ways in which people live religious lives, you know, through the centuries or in different areas of the world or even across different communities in the U.S. Rather, what is really meant is Christianity, right? And we can see this in the way that religious freedom is currently invoked in the United States, in which religious freedom historically in the U.S. courts has almost always been applied as applying mostly to Christian claims, not always or completely, but mostly. And certainly now it's Christian claims that stand up in the U.S. Supreme Court. So, for example, when the court took up the current administration's ban on travel from Muslim majority countries, religious freedom was not central to the ways in which the court decided that ban was in fact constitutional. It was not invoked there. So religion gets narrowed to Christianity. Christianity then also gets narrowed. The diversity among positions across Christians in the United States is narrowed to an assumption that Christianity itself is conservative, and it's conservative about values, and then those values are about sex. And so what happens is we get something in which the broad diversity of the way that people live their lives gets narrowed to a very specific idea in which religion and Christianity and conservative Christianity and sexually conservative Christianity all become seen as synonyms, as reference to the same thing. And so it's that narrowing of public discourse that I'm concerned about. And, you know, this comes from a couple of different places. One is what we in religious studies would call Christian hegemony. And what we think about in relation to that is the development of the idea of religion itself. And we, Anne and I, in secularisms, argue that that development comes in part from the division between religiosity and secularism in European and American modernity. So that, for example, within the Catholic Church, historically, there used to be secular clerics and religious clerics, depending on what type of priest, for example, one might be. But then secularism became something that was separate from religion, and it became, secularism became the framework within which we understood what religion was. And that idea that, you know, when we study, you know, in a secular university, for example, religion, we're studying something that fits a particular category, ties religion and secularism together. And it also turns out that historically religion was based on the model of Christianity. For example, there's a book by a scholar named David Chittister in South Africa that talks about the ways in which the colonial period saw responses to religious practices in South Africa as either just like European Christianity or completely different, depending on what was happening in the colonial period, but it was always in relation to a Christian understanding of what religion is. And so that's what we mean by Christian hegemony in the study of religion. And that contributes to this narrowing of political discourse I'm talking about. And then within the United States specifically, there's a particular brand of Christian nationalism that is helped along by this Christian hegemony. If religion means Christianity, then to say that religion, that the U.S. is a religious nation is also the same as saying that it's a Christian nation. And that's then tied to a whole history of the United States that, again, most scholars in religion do not see as accurate, but it is the idea that the country was founded on Christian ideas and principles. And, you know, of course, first of all, this erases the indigenous people who were here and to have their own practices, which we may or may not think of as religious. In erasing indigeneity, right, we get a story of a founding of the country. And then that founding was much more complex, and the commitments that people had was much more complex than what we usually think of in the singular sort of the Puritans came to the United States, and that formed the entire understanding of Christian nationalism in the United States. So those sources, these narratives about what religion is and narratives about what the United States are, then play into this specific question of religion and sexuality.
So I'm going to ask you my next question, but it might be a little bit repetitive, but I just want to make sure we unpack this before moving on. So in the book, you challenge the standard and simplistic, you argue, a narrative that religion drives sexual politics and is the primary force behind sexual regulation. Why is it important to break this narrative down?
Yeah, so just to give you an example here, and this is from one of those projects at the Barnard Center for Research on Women that I was talking about. I worked on a project with an activist named Taloma Jayasingha, who was at the time director of Saki for South Asian Women, which is a local organization in New York that addresses sexual violence in South Asian community. Saki, in trying to address domestic violence, found itself trapped in this opposition, where on the one hand, you know, it was, if we assume that religion is the source of sexual regulation and of gender hierarchy, then religion is somehow a problem that is driving domestic violence. And we can, you know, argue that there are all kinds of other things that contribute to domestic violence, you know, economic anxiety, other, you know, commitments to gender hierarchy that are shared across secular and religious sources, et cetera. But the idea that religion is a special problem in relation to violence then put the South Asian immigrant community in a very problematic place, because they would somehow have to undo their commitments to religion in order to address sexual violence, right? So that the opposition is then set up. You can either supposedly choose, you know, gender equality or religious commitment. You can't have them both, when in fact in the community there are many people who are committed to both things, including people who participate in sake. And then on the other side of the opposition, the secular state is seen as the protector of this secular freedom, when in fact what many South Asians found, particularly Muslims after September 11th, 2001, found was that the secular state and the policing was not a site of protection and help, but a site of surveillance and sometimes threat to the community as a whole. So that violence, the violence of the secular state that the community faced, disappeared. It was very hard to talk about because violence and gender violence in particular supposedly came from religion. And so what they set out to do was a project that ended up being called Responding to Violence, Restoring Justice, which was to find ways of addressing domestic violence that did not require giving up religious commitment and that didn't require necessarily calling upon the secular state, that were more about mutual aid and helping people to find economic security, for example, and finding ways for people to tell their narratives in the complex way that they experience them without having to fit into a one side or the other kind of simplistic narrative. So that project shows how this narrative, the religion secular narrative, traps not just politics, but people, and how telling different types of stories can open up possibilities that would make it easier to do the work that Saki is trying to do in addressing domestic violence.
So you use the image of a spiraling kaleidoscope in order to better understand the complex dynamics of intersecting issues such as sex, gender, race, class, migration, nationalism, capitalism, globalization, healthcare, and war, to name a few. Can you describe the image of the kaleidoscope and how, in your estimation, it offers a more thorough understanding of sexual politics?
All right. So what I've been describing so far is a back and forth oscillation between these two poles of, you know, supposed opposition. And we see this a lot where we move back and forth, you know, between pro and anti on various issues without being able to break out into a different kind of conversation. One of the things I was thinking about in the book is how would we try to describe this different kind of conversation? And I started with the concept that Black feminists have developed, which is usually associated with Kimberly Crenshaw's early articles on intersectionality. Patricia Hill Collins has also developed important work along these lines. And I started thinking about intersectionality in a dynamic fashion. How do we talk about the ways in which issues are related to each other and yet are also moving around each other and sometimes coming to the fore and sometimes you know, moving to the back the background of a given image. So you know, just as an example, as I was doing my analysis of the public discourse around the 2016 elections, and as you may know, the U.S. Is often described as being caught in a culture war between, again, you know, sort of conservatives, sexual conservatives, and more liberal positions. And the way that culture war was described, it seemed that it was always moving. So people would say, oh, you know, the 2016 culture war is very different. It's not about gender and sexuality any longer, although it clearly was. There was a lot of interest in the question of what would happen with judicial appointments, which has in fact been central to the current administration. Instead, there were arguments that it was about economic anxiety, or that, again, immigration was the central issue, when immigration had, in fact, been a persistent concern in the culture wars, starting from Pat Buchanan's speech about this in support of George Bush's election, and so in the early 90s. What I saw was this sense that issues were brought to the fore and others pushed to the background, when in fact they were interrelated. They formed a pattern together. They were, to go back to the Black feminist term, they were intersectional. And so I wanted to find a way to describe that movement in relation to each other. And what I came to realize is that what this movement did was make it seem as if everything was new again by focusing on a single issue, and we didn't have to analyze in our political life the ways in which these interrelations had persistent effects. So just to give you one example, which is the way in which we think about sexuality as about a certain set of issues. So there's, you know, gender issues around equal pay, gender equality, domestic violence, transgender rights, and then there's sexual issues around same-sex marriage and contraception, reproductive justice. Those issues are generally recognized as about gender and sexuality, and they go back and forth in this oscillating way. But I also did an analysis of where gender and sexuality showed up in other issues that were moving around each other and around gender and sexuality, and these would be economic equality and justice. They would be race and racism in the United States. They would be immigration, healthcare, home, housing policy, and the like, the environment, war and peace. And what I found was that in that movement, oh, today we're talking about gender and sexuality, but it's only these issues. But when it's in relation to other issues, in fact, there's some consistency. Gender and sexual regulation are used by both Democratic and Republican administrations, for example, in holding in place a relatively narrow set of policy interests. The ways in which, for example, someone like Bill Clinton would appeal to tropes about specifically race and gender and sexuality around his effort to do what he called end welfare as we know it. He had campaigned on this in 1992. That his use of gender and sexual regulation around ideas about teenage pregnancy, which Bill Bradley, who was senator from New Jersey at the time, very clearly states in the congressional record, this is code for young, poor women of color. He appealed to these tropes as a way to make a major change to the Social Security Act of 1935 in changing aid to families with dependent children. So you would not expect that kind of sexual conservatism, which is really what it was, and, an invocation of racist imagery as a way to promote economic policy. You know, Clinton also famously campaigned on the idea that it's the economy, stupid, that the economy was separate from, for example, these culture war issues. But in fact, he used them just as much. I don't know if just as much, but he certainly used them in ways that were similar to the ways that Republicans used them. And it's that consistency in which we have a kaleidoscope where the pieces of the pattern move in relation to each other, but the patterns still are held within the center of the kaleidoscope. So I don't make as much of this as I might, but by the end, you have to think about ways maybe to break open the kaleidoscope even. But I'm trying to track those dynamics which produce what I call mobility for stasis. So we see movement on gender and sexuality. We see movement between gender and sexuality is now the important thing, and next week it's economics. And yet what we end up with is a relatively constrained political discourse.
I'm going to ask you about mobility for stasis, but in a minute, so I'll pause there. Before we move on, though, I'm just wondering if we could, if you could share with us another example or two. You mentioned Clinton with welfare, and it's about the economy, stupid, I think is what the slogan was. But can you bring up another example or two that really show us the, what you're trying to demonstrate with this kaleidoscope imagery here with,
Yeah. One of the things that happens is when you pull an issue out as a single issue, right? So when you look at what's only at the center of the pattern in the kaleidoscope, and you don't look at its relation to other issues, what happens is that those other issues can operate without with great power and yet without taking responsibility for them. So just to go back to the welfare reform example, and then I'll return to what some of the other examples are as I looked at different presidential administrations. When I read the congressional record for about the debate over welfare reform, I did what is called coding. And what that means is that you track how many times references to different themes show up. And the way we used to do this, now you can do it with digital tools almost instantly, but we would highlight, literally go through the text and highlight in different colors. And so in this example, I was using green for economic issues because it was supposed to be the economy only as Clinton presented it, and pink for this talk about teenage pregnancy and gender and sexuality. And what I found in the congressional record, it surprised even me, which was there was a few greens here and there, a little bit of talk of the economy, you know, some reference to the law that was being changed, the Social Security Act, but mostly it was just pink. It was just gender and sexuality. When I did the same thing around the news reporting, it was quite the opposite. There was a real focus in the news reporting on, oh, you know, we're ending welfare, we're changing, you know, the structure of the welfare state. And the ways in which gender and sexuality had propelled this argument was much less apparent. And so part of what I was trying to do with the idea of the kaleidoscope is show the ways in which, oh, when we focus only on the economy, gender and sexuality operates powerfully. Senator after senator is talking about it. And yet, when we think about the issue, we are not saying, is this really how we want to think about the Social Security Act? Do we really want to think about it, about whether teenage young women have children or not? And in fact, one of the things that came out of the bill that was eventually passed and signed by President Clinton is support for something that's called marriage promotion. And for every administration since that time, so, you know, Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and the current administration, all of them have spent millions and millions of dollars on what's called marriage promotion as a response to poverty. So the idea is, well, if you could just get married and stay married, then you would somehow, you know, not be facing the economic security of low wages and jobs without benefits and the like. You would be able to move out of poverty. And this idea that gender and sexuality, marriage, is the answer to problems with poverty in the United States in a time which, from the 1990s, has seen this intense expansion of economic inequality is rarely talked about. There's rarely any sense that we're taking gender and sexuality seriously, even though that is a major, you know, piece of the policy platform of all of these different administrations.
This might seem like a simple question, but I'm just curious about unpacking it. So mm-hmm. Why do gender and sexuality appear? I'm thinking of your pink highlighter Why do gender and sexuality appear in issues that seemingly have little to do with gender and sexuality? What is the purpose of this? Why does this happen?
Yeah, two things. So there are two scholars, Lauren Berlant and Lisa Dugan, say that gender and sexuality in U.S. political discourse are both overvalued and undervalued. And we can see this in the way that things worked out with my pink highlighter, right? So, you know, thinking that teenage mothers were a great threat to the nation, you know, I have a colleague named Tracy West who read all of Clinton's speeches and demonstrates the ways in which Clinton's, you know, talking about teenage motherhood repeatedly in different sites was central to his argument that we needed to, quote, end welfare as we know it. Right? That's an overvaluing of sexuality. It is not the case that young women having children are the sources of poverty in the United States. And then there's an undervaluing of gender and sexuality, which is that we deny that, in fact, gender and sexuality are central to, for example, economic policy, even as we enshrine ideas about gender and sexuality all over the place. So our housing policy is very dedicated to the production of single family homes, even though that is probably not best for the environment, that it creates all kinds of challenges for housing in urban areas where housing is very, very expensive. And we just have a great deal of difficulty acknowledging that we've organized housing around one specific idea about a relationship in a single family, married and two children, when that's not necessarily how people live, and it's not necessarily the way in which to create a situation in which people can best care for each other. So, for example, in this pandemic, one of the things we've seen is how challenging it is when people are thrown back on these individual units, and when many people are then left living alone. And people then go outside familial units. They try to form pods or quarantines or find other ways to connect with and care for each other that we don't generally think about because U.S. policy is so focused on this single idea of the family. And so our inability to think about the ways in which gender and sex are important, they do form the way that people make their lives. People do have values about this. They, you know, care deeply about the ways in which they organize their intimate lives. They care deeply about the ways in which they can find to, you know, care for each other. These are all issues that matter a great deal that we, in fact, have trouble acknowledging. That's the undervaluing of gender and sexuality. The overvaluing is the ways in which it can be invoked. What I argue is that gender and sexuality can be invoked to invoke a whole set of issues, right? So economic issues, et cetera. That's the kaleidoscope. You put gender and sexuality in the center, and it has a configuration around it that is very powerful. And at the same time, we could and should, I would argue, pay much more attention to gender and sexuality and the ways in which people try to make their lives and care for each other.
So you mentioned earlier mobility for stasis. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if we could unpack this term and if you can maybe share some examples that highlight the dynamics of this term.
And I'll give you two. One is to follow up on this question of the ways in which gender and sexuality can be at the center of the kaleidoscope to pull a whole set of other issues in, and then we turn it. So there is, for example, a story about the 1970s in the United States around religion that, again, most historians of religion now argue is inaccurate, but it's frequently told, which is that when evangelical Christians who are conservatives, so Christian conservatives, moved into U.S. political life in new ways in the 1970s, it was because of abortion politics. And what I do is synthesize a set of histories about the U.S. in the 1970s to show that, as a number of historians have said, this is not accurate, that it was sex alone that drove this issue, that in fact we have a set of issues that include racial politics and especially responses to efforts to desegregate U.S. public schools through busing, and anti-busing efforts became connected to gender and sexual conservatism, became connected to arguments over the meaning of religious freedom and whether Christian prayer was allowed in public schools. But those also became connected to anti-communism and through figures like Billy Graham or through connections to right-wing organizations like the John Birch Society. And it became, connected to a broader set of economic issues that are tied to this question of the nuclear family becoming the, quote, traditional family, even though it was really a formation that only became predominant in the U.S. after World War II. But with suburbanization in particular, it became important. And all these things became a constellation. And that constellation moves around. So sometimes what comes to the fore is gender and sexuality. And we say, oh, no, it's, abortion politics is the problem. And if we were just to remove reproductive justice from the way people talk about politics, everything would be okay. And now one of the things we see is that some people are now reading this history as if, oh no, it's all white Christian nationalism because that has come to the fore in certain ways. And we shouldn't talk about gender and sexuality because, you know, that takes away focus on race when in fact these things are intertwined. That's what intersectionality means. And that not being able to address the relation between racism in the U.S., Christian nationalism and gender and sexual politics is part of the problem. It, you know, separating these things is not the solution. So the 1970s and the way in which these issues came together in a complex or a configuration that's held together even as they move around each other is one example. And then the second one I look at in the book is about U.S. Supreme Court cases in which we see something similar where in one moment, we say, oh, look, you know, in 2013, there was a first step toward what in 2015 became the legalization of same-sex marriage. And, you know, we're making progress on gender and sexuality even as, and what I show is, in fact, in the very same week as the beginnings of this opening to same-sex marriage, which in that case in 2013 was the declaring of the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional. So we have this focus on progress for gay and lesbian rights, even as the same week it was announced that parts of the Voting Rights Act would no longer be enforced. And that decision, which was in a case called Shelby County v. Holder, is having tremendous effects on the current electoral process because states that at one time had to submit to federal oversight about plans with regard to voting restrictions have been enacting all kinds of voting restrictions that have had very similar effects to the ones from before the Voting Rights Act, which is to make it harder for, particularly for people of color to vote. And so that sense that there could be this focus on progress for gender and sexuality, and it really did. I again do an analysis of the press coverage during that week, and there was much more coverage on progress for gender and sexuality, in part covered over the ways in which the country was really shifting back quite directly on questions of voting rights, and that the import of that decision really was diffused by its relation to talk about gender.
Can you more succinctly sort of define what you mean by mobility for stasis?
Oh, of course.
Mobility
yeah,
for
sorry.
Stasis?
Yeah.
No, that's okay.
I in my notes, I had that one as, you know, right up front. So, yes. So what I mean by mobility for stasis is this. There is a lot going on in U.S. politics all the time, and we have all kinds of ways in which our media also encourages the sense that there's a lot going on. We have, you know, 24-hour news channels and, you know, really now mainstream outlets like Politico that are just on, you know, what's happening in Washington today. And so there's a lot of activity, but one of the things that I am particularly interested in is the basic issues around which this activity is going on seem to change very little. And I mean that in two ways. One, the political spectrum between the United States is not that broad. It's broader in other countries, and we move between sort of a center-left, center-right. But when I document consistency across the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, the current administration, part of what I'm showing is that there's not that much breadth despite all that this activity in our political life in the United States. And the other thing that remains stubbornly persistent are the injustices that our democracy is supposed to address. So to go back to the example of voting rights, how is it that the United States, which was supposedly, again, in this nationalist narrative, is supposedly founded on, you know, freedom and democracy, how is it that over these centuries now, we have had to repeatedly return to questions of who gets to vote, and in particular to the ways in which African-American people coming out of slavery are denied the vote, and we also try to deny the vote to more people of color in the United States. So, for example, voting rights in some states in the Southwest are focused on trying to prevent Latinos from being able to vote, including, you know, not having polling places in particular neighborhoods and the like. So this question for me is, why is it that we should still be all these centuries later focused on trying to get the vote? This is very basic to any democratic possibility, to what will soon be the majority of people in the United States. Like, how is it that voting rights are still an issue? And it's that sense in which I'm interested in how it is that we have narratives, including the progress narrative, which maybe we can talk about some more, that make it seem like, oh, this is all getting better, democracy is expanding, and yet we return time and time again to similar injustices. This is also true about housing segregation, about segregation in public schooling. There are all kinds of issues in which we just return to the same ground again and again and again. And that, what I'm trying to document in Mobility for Stasis, is the type of movement that leads back to the same hierarchies and injustices that have persisted and that come from the colonial period, the founding of the nation, the destruction of indigenous peoples, and slavery.
So you just offered a perfect segue. Why don't we talk about the progress narrative? What does this mean? And what does your, and you sort of, you alluded to this already, and but what, how does your, the idea of Mobility for Stasis challenge the commonly held progress narrative?
Right. And the progress narrative has different versions to it or aspects to it. There's one sort of bigger narrative that is associated actually with the relationship between religion and secularism. And then there's a narrative that's specific to U.S. nationalism. The bigger narrative is that humanity is making progress and it's moving from resolving conflicts around violence or a political force in a way in which, you know, life is brutish and short, to the ability to resolve conflicts peacefully, without force, and through what Jürgen Habermas calls the force of the better argument, right? So that there's a move toward reason as resolving political conflict rather than political violence. And this narrative often puts religion as in the past. So one of the things that societies are progressing away from is religious commitment. And again, you can see how religion gets associated with violence here. And that reason is associated with secularism, with freedom, and now with freedom from violence and from justice. And that big progress narrative is part of what I look at in the book, and it's part of what Anne and I look at in the Secularisms Project, because it associates all these different things, secularism, freedom, equality, gender equality, et cetera, that then get drawn out in the particular narrative of U.S. nationalism. And that U.S. nationalist narrative, it could be summarized as some historians do, as democracy expands, and that they use it as a shorthand for this narrative, in which the presumption is, well, yes, it's true. When U.S. democracy was first instituted, many of the founders were slaveholders. Native American peoples were removed in many ways from the contract and from their homelands. And only men of property could vote. Only men could vote. These were all problems, and we recognize that they run counter to democracy. But the good part is that we have progressed from there, right? We have, slavery was ended. We opened U.S. democracy with the 15th Amendment to African American men voting. We opened with the 19th Amendment to women voting. And so we just see this continuing expansion. And part of what I'm interested in is, except for that, isn't exactly what happened. So why then did we need a Voting Rights Act in the 1960s for both African American men and African American women to be able actually to vote? And so I'm interested in the progress that didn't happen. And one of the things, to go back to the kaleidoscope, that I find is that this narrative about progress is often told in a stepping stone fashion. So first, one group moves forward to get their rights you know, the 15th Amendment, then the next group moves forward, the 19th Amendment, and it goes like that. And the way it's told in relation to more recent history is first, African Americans came forward with the civil rights movement, then, you know, gay and lesbian people with their civil rights movement. And what that stepping stone narrative does is precisely hide the ways in which these issues are related to each other in these patterns or social configurations that we find, and hide the way in which this mobility leads us back to the same point again and again and again. So just as an example, right now in the state of Florida, there's a lot of contention between, because in the 2018 election cycle, they voted on a referendum, the people of Florida did, and they voted to re-enfranchise people who had been convicted of felonies and who had had their voting rights denied to them. This was a, you know, direct popular vote. But then the legislature passed a law that says that felons, yes, can vote because this is referendum is has passed, but they must first pay any fines that they owe. And this, the fines that people are subjected to after incarceration are really complex. And often people, you know, don't have the economic means to pay them. And so it is effectively a poll tax, which is one of the things that the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act we're trying to undo is poll taxes. So we're now back to something that was supposedly resolved in this democracy expands narrative. And so part of what I'm trying to say is it's a good narrative and you can see where it comes from. There are things that are better, but there are also things that persistently never get better. And that's one of the questions that I want to ask is why is that? Why does it feel like, as I say at one point in the book, social change is happening and yet many things never change? Part of what the book is about is trying to track that and then to think about ways in which we could shift our thinking and then our actions so that they might actually change, that we can contribute to more substantive transformation.
Okay, so to start wrapping up our interview, I'm going to ask you a question that you pose in the book. Why sex?
Yes, you know, and the answer that I give at one point is because religion, because sex, because everything. And what I mean by that is this. It's not that religion has no place in sexual politics in the United States. It clearly does. And by sexual politics, I should have said this at the beginning. What I mean is issues related to both gender and sexuality and the ways in which gender and sexuality relate to politics as a whole. So it's a broad category. So I'm interested in the role that religion plays, but I am not interested in allowing that to be the only thing because that covers over a whole set of commitments that are generally seen as secular. Like economic commitments and issues like immigration that we've been talking about that are also committed to sexual regulation. So because religion, yes. Because sex, what I mean by that, and we've touched on this briefly, is that people have a lot of commitments about sexual politics that you know, sex doesn't always stand in for something else. That in fact, gender and sexuality are important to people. One of the reasons, for example, that it's important to recognize people's gender identities is precisely because this is central to how they live their lives, how they want to embody themselves. Everybody has a gender identity and they organize their life in some way around this gender identity. And this includes, you know, being gender nonconforming is a powerful statement about gender and why it's important to resist, you know, simply being locked into gender categories. So, you know, gender and sexuality are important in and of themselves. And as we touched on earlier, it would be helpful if we could talk about those kinds of commitments directly. You know, as I say, as Anne and I say in the book, and then I draw it more in the introduction, you know, sex is a source of values. People make lives based on what they value. And part of that is through sexual practices that connect them to other people. The example that Anne and I use in Love the Sin is commitments to caring for each other, to mutual aid during the AIDS pandemic. And we can see the ways in which these kinds of values about intimate relations and caring could play out hopefully in this pandemic, where we could find ways to care for our neighbors in new and different formations. So sexual politics, why sex? Because sex matters. And then the because everything is because it's, and it matters in part because gender and sexuality are intertwined broadly in this full range of issues, some of which we've touched on today. So that sense that we could attend to sexual politics where we don't overvalue it, but where we could, you know, recognize it in the various places where it does pop up. There's a moment when I draw on the work of historian Anne Browdy, who says, we should look for religion in unexpected places. That's a way to break out of the religion secularism binary. So, for example, there are a whole series of worker centers in the United States that are about organizing workers who are not necessarily the subject of usual labor organizing in the U.S. So restaurant workers, domestic workers, day laborers, et cetera. That's what worker centers do. Many of these are driven by people of faith. They're interfaith centers, interfaith worker centers. But we rarely think of, you know, labor politics as simply a religious issue in the way that U.S. politics works out. And similarly, I argue that we should think about sex in the places that it shows up, unexpected places though they may be, and that in doing so, we could open up politics in a different way, that by allowing, for example, a recognition of the ways in which people need people beyond their individual families, as so many people are finding who are trying to educate their children online right now, where, yeah, we need schools, right? We need people who care for children who are not just the parents of these children. That thinking about sexual politics more broadly could also provide a way out and a way to rethink a number of issues, such as the relationship between gender and sexuality, housing, and the environment, or gender and sexuality, housing, and urban policy. This is not the usual way we would talk about it, and I think it could help to open things up in new ways and think more broadly about the way in which we create our social worlds.
To conclude on a broad note, I'm wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now.
Yeah. So at the very end of the book, what I talk about in terms of trying to put this idea of the ways in which sexual politics could help us to build a different politics is what I call building justice from the ground up. And what I mean by that is a lot of things I have discovered. And so my new book is on that specifically. But in this book, what I mean by that is, how do people actually live their lives? Let us start there. So rather than saying, we know what is a good arrangement of gender and sexuality, it is, you know, heterosexual marriage, therefore we will spend all kinds of, you know, public monies, tax monies on marriage promotion, even though there's very little data that shows that this helps people either stay married or get out of poverty. But instead, justice from the ground up looks at how do people live their lives and how can we attend to that in ways that create social policy that help them to realize their values. And I turn here to disability activism in particular. My partner lives with a spinal cord injury and uses a wheelchair, and I'm interested in the ways in which attending to the needs of disabled people, and there's no single paradigmatic, you know, disabled person. You know, there's all kinds of needs, you know, environmental illness, vision impairments, et cetera, that we could attend to. But one of the things that we find in disability activism is that if you attend to the needs of disabled people, you often make the world better for many more people than just disabled people. And I use the example of curb cuts. So if you were in New York City, where there are cuts in the curbs, as there are in many cities, to allow for wheelchair access, what you find is everybody uses them. Walking people go through them. People with strollers, baby strollers, use them. People with carts, because you have to often are walking and carrying groceries around in New York. So this sense of something that was supposedly specific to disabled people actually creates a more universal a set of possibilities. And similarly, attending to the lives that people live in terms of gender and sexuality could create a world that would be better for a lot of people. So attending to the ways in which people are making quarantine pods right now could help us to think about how we would make social policy that could support people in communities that are sustainable. So these are some of the things that I think about in terms of justice from the ground up. And my new book is precisely about this. I'm actually thinking about what comes out of the ground. I'm taking a class at the in forestry right now, in forest dynamics, trying to think about how things literally grow from the ground, and then building from there through examples like housing policy and caring labor, to be able to try to think about what is it that actually could sustain social life in a new and different way, and how could we make policy that attends to that.
Well, thank you so much, Janet, for joining us today. It really was a pleasure talking to you about this book and also hearing about your future projects. So thank you so much. The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics is out now.
Thank you.